things, like our reason and our will, then it's time to break our necks for home. There are no events but thoughts and the heart's hard turning, the heart's slow learning where to love and whom. The rest is merely gossip and tales for other times. Annie Dillard, Holy the Firm. The helicopter labors upward, thwack, thwack, thwacking over the shoulder of Mount Healy. As the altimeter needle brushes 5,000 feet, we crest a mud-colored ridge, the earth drops away, and a breathtaking sweep of taiga fills the plexiglass windscreen. In the distance, I can pick out the Stampede Trail, cutting a faint, crooked stripe from east to west across the landscape. Billy McCandless is in the front passenger seat. Walt and I occupy the back. 10 hard months have passed since Sam McCandless appeared at their Chesapeake Beach doorstep to tell them Chris was dead. It is time, they have decided, to visit the place where their son met his end, to see it with their own eyes. Walt has spent the past 10 days in Fairbanks doing contract work for NASA, developing an airborne radar system for search and rescue missions that will enable searchers to find the wreckage of a downed plane amid thousands of acres of densely forested country. For several days now, he's been distracted, irritable, edgy. Billy, who arrived in Alaska 2 days ago, confided to me that the prospect of visiting the bus has been difficult for him to come to terms with. Surprisingly, she says she feels calm and centered and has been looking forward to this trip for some time. Taking a helicopter was a last-minute change of plans. Billy wanted badly to travel overland, to follow the Stampede Trail as Chris had done. Toward that end, she'd contacted Butch Killian, the Healy coal miner who'd been present when Chris's body was discovered, and he agreed to drive Walt and Billy into the bus on his all-terrain vehicle. But yesterday, Killian called their hotel to say that the Teklanika River was still running high, too high, he worried, to cross safely, even with his amphibious 8-wheeled Argo, thus the helicopter. 2,000 feet beneath the aircraft's skids, a mottled green tweed of muskeg and spruce forest now blankets the rolling country. The Teklanika appears as a long brown ribbon thrown carelessly across the land. An unnaturally bright object comes into view near the confluence of two smaller streams, Fairbanks Bus 142. It has taken us 15 minutes to cover the distance it took Chris 4 days to walk. The helicopter settles noisily onto the ground, the pilot kills the engine, and we hop down onto sandy earth. A moment later, the machine lifts off in a hurricane of prop wash, leaving us surrounded by a monumental silence. As Walt and Billy stand 10 yards from the bus, staring at the anomalous vehicle without speaking, a trio of jays prattles from a nearby aspen tree. "It's smaller," Billy finally says, "than I thought it would be. I mean the bus." And then, turning to take in the surroundings, "What a pretty place. I can't believe how much this reminds me of where I grew up." "Oh, Walt, it looks just like the Upper Peninsula. Chris must have loved being here." "I have a lot of reasons for disliking Alaska, okay?" Walt answers, scowling. "But I admit it, the place has a certain beauty. I can see what appealed to Chris." For the next 30 minutes, Walt and Billy walk quietly around the decrepit vehicle, amble down to the Shoshana River, visit the nearby woods. Billy is the first to enter the bus. Walt returns from the stream to find her sitting on the mattress where Chris died, taking in the vehicle's shabby interior. For a long time, she gazes silently at her son's boots under the stove, his handwriting on the walls, his toothbrush. But today there are no tears. Picking through the clutter on the table, she bends to examine a spoon with a distinctive floral pattern on the handle. "Walt, look at this," she says. "This is the silverware we had in the Annandale house." At the front of the bus, Billy picks up a pair of Chris's patched, ragged jeans, and closing her eyes, presses them to her face. "Smell," she urges her husband with a painful smile. "They still smell like Chris." After a long beat, she declares to herself more than to anyone else, "He must have been very brave and very strong at the end, not to do himself in." Billy and Walt wander in and out of the bus for the next 2 hours. Walt installs a memorial just inside the door, a simple brass plaque inscribed with a few words. Beneath it, Billy arranges a bouquet of fireweed, monkshood, yarrow, and spruce boughs. Under the bed at the rear of the bus, she leaves a suitcase stocked with a first aid kit, canned food, other survival supplies. A note urging whoever happens to read it to call your parents as soon as possible. The suitcase also holds a Bible that belonged to Chris when he was a child, even though she allows, "I haven't prayed since we lost him." Walt, in a reflective mood, has little to say, but he appears more at ease than he has in many days. "I didn't know how I was going to react to this," he admits, gesturing toward the bus. "But now I'm glad we came." This brief visit, he says, has given him a slightly better understanding of why his boy came into this country. There is much about Chris that still baffles him, and always will, but now he is a little less baffled, and for that small solace he is grateful. "It's comforting to know Chris was here," Billy explains, "to know for certain that he spent time beside this river, that he stood on this patch of ground. So many places we visited in the past 3 years, we'd wonder if possibly Chris had been there. It was terrible not knowing anything at all." Many people have told me that they admire Chris for what he was trying to do. If he'd lived, I would agree with them. But he didn't, and there's no way to bring him back. You can't fix it. Most things you can fix, but not that. I don't know that you ever get over this kind of loss. The fact that Chris is gone is a sharp hurt I feel every single day. It's really hard. Some days are better than others, but it's going to be hard every day for the rest of my life. Abruptly, the quiet is shattered by the percussive racket of the helicopter, which spirals down from the clouds and lands in a patch of fireweed. We climb inside. The chopper shoulders into the sky and then hovers for a moment before banking steeply to the southeast. For a few minutes, the roof of the bus remains visible among the stunted trees, a tiny white gleam in a wild green sea, growing smaller and smaller, and then it's gone. This concludes the reading of Into the Wild by John Krakauer. This book was read by Philip Franklin.